comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are and wherever you happen to be all around this beautiful planet. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on earth. We are here because you have a right to know and because you matter. Well, last week was quite a week. We had one blockbuster show after another. And for our new listeners, that may be something new, but let me assure you, that's not rare here at the Kevin Smith Show. It's just how we do things, and we intend to do that again this week. Among our guests this week, you're going to find Jeff Harvey. Jeff is the man who had an implant taken out of his leg by Dr. Lear's team on national television. Now, this was the implant that was found to be transmitting on deep space frequency. You may remember that. Jeff's health improved dramatically, almost instantly after the implant was removed. But then, months later, an organism of unknown origin attacked the foot on that same leg. This organism would not respond to treatment, and eventually Jeff had to have his leg amputated. In fact, that amputation took place just weeks ago, and he is now recovering. He's going to join us to talk about his painful and rather terrifying ordeal and to talk about the possible link between the implant and that organism. Tonight, we have former U.S. Air Force OSI Special Agent Walter Bosley with us to talk about a murder investigation with some harrowing implications. The murder was ruled a suicide at the time, and the time was back in the early 1900s. But Walter Bosley found evidence that said otherwise. The account of this mysterious death contains intrigue, occult societies, dark powers, and mind-bending possibilities that extend right up into our present time. He'll join us after this upcoming break. Let me remind you, if you have not yet subscribed to the K-Files, be sure you do. It's our free weekly newsletter. And all you have to do is click where it says K-Files right there on my website. And subscribe. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. In our members area, you have the ability to watch the show as well as listen to the show. And for those in the members area tonight, let me tell you, we have something special for you on our TV channel after the show. You may want to stay tuned. And also, let me draw your attention, all of you, to something on our website at kevinsmithshow.com. In the upper right-hand side of the website, you'll find a link that says Freebies, KSS Freebies. Well, we've got some shows for you, not a whole bunch. We've got a couple of shows over there that I think you'll find interesting, and you can download those to your computer free. The first one you can also download to iPhone or Android. And the second one, it will be, you'll be able to do that by this time tomorrow. We're going to step away for just a couple of minutes here, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Walter Bosley. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We have as our guest this evening Walter Bosley. Walter is no stranger to our audience, our regular audience. You are accustomed to Walter being with us here on the show. He's been with us many times over a number of years. And what's interesting about Walter is each time he's on the show with us, we're talking about something different. He's not just a single-dimensional kind of personality. This guy has lots of talents, lots of interests, and is very knowledgeable about many, many subjects. Walter, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thanks for having me on again, Kevin. I always appreciate being here.
Walter, you have a new book out, and I mean really new. I mean, this book has just hit the market. It's called Empire of the Wheel, and I know that you've been working on this book now for at least 3 years, maybe longer than that, but for at least 3 years, you and I have been talking about various aspects of this book, and I know why it has that title, The Empire of the Wheel, but our audience does not, at least not yet. So let's begin by just jumping right into the story of this book, which involves the death of a young woman in the early 1900s. Just kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of this death and why it caught your attention.
Well, the woman in question is known as Cora Stanton. This was the name that she's associated with.
Oh, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me interrupt for just a moment. Folks, this is not a novel. This is not fiction. Okay, go ahead.
And thanks for mentioning that. This is most definitely a work of nonfiction, and it is primarily a true crime book, in spite of all the esoterica that's in the book and that we're going to discuss. But it all, the mystery really kicks off with what surrounds this woman, Cora Stanton, who was found floating dead in a lake in a park which does not exist anymore, called Urbita Springs Park, that was once the pride and joy of San Bernardino, California. Now, nobody knew who she was, and at the time she was found, there was no name associated with her. She was just a stranger to town, and she was described as being anywhere from 18 to 30 years old until they finally pinpointed her around, you know, in her early to mid-30s, around 35. She was a woman who hadn't known much physical hardship with labor or such, because she was found with, you know, soft, gentle hands. She was about 5 feet tall, you know, 135 pounds. You know, she wasn't a homeless, you know, person scraping for food to get by. She was found to be in generally good, you know, strong health, and her clothes were decent clothes. They were practically new, and they were nice. So, mystery as to why this woman was found dead in this lake. And I first learned about her when I was doing some follow-up research to my other book, Latitude 33, just some, you know, some fun research. And I was looking for paranormal activity associated with the ley lines that extended out from the Disneyland area, those of you who are familiar with my book. And I heard about this ghost story associated with the Inland Center Mall that's here in San Bernardino. And I specifically learned about Cora Stanton from a local librarian named Ann Walker. After I talked with Ann, who expressed an opinion that Cora Stanton, who allegedly I learned from her was a suicide, a woman who had just gotten tired of it all and thrown herself into the lake, and suspected that there was foul play involved, and she suggested I go look at the newspaper accounts. So I did, and I spent the better part of a day in the special collections area of the Feldheim branch of the San Bernardino Public Library. And I got to know Cora Stanton, but I also found some other things. I found a lot more facts that made me tend to agree with Ann Walker that this woman, Cora Stanton, indeed had died possibly at the hands of a murderer, or, you know, that there definitely was foul play involved. But I also discovered that there were several other deaths that were very curious in their circumstances. And my first impression, after spending that first day with these copies of microfilm, if you can imagine that, those of you who are of a certain age remember microfilm, after I spent several hours and I poured through the only available public record of these deaths and this mystery, I came away with my criminal investigator's hat on with a very strong hunch that something odd and something very spooky and certainly criminal had gone on here.
What tipped you off? What is it that...
I ended up on quite a roller coaster ride.
What is it that tipped you off and said, aha, this was not a suicide?
Well, you have this woman who, Cora Stanton, so to speak, and you'll hear me say that because I'm not convinced that that was her real name, and the book explains why in detail. You have this woman who's found floating dead in the lake. She's also discovered, in the subsequent coroner's examination, to have poison in her stomach. In the days right before she's found dead, two little children are discovered to have been given poisoned candy. They are 4 and 2 years old, a little boy and a little girl, brother and sister, and nobody knows where they got the candy. The parents are cleared right off. No sign or scrap of what this poison would have been or any other sample of this candy that they ate was found anywhere near the home or anything. Just these kids were given poison candy by somebody, and they were dying. And the little girl died around the time that Cora Stanton's body was found in the lake, and the little boy died just shortly after. And the poison was never identified. It could not be identified. Then I discovered that there's a 14-year-old girl over in Redlands. The two children, the Estep children, were in a community here where I live, Highland, California. Just a stone's throw from my house is where they died. But a 14-year-old girl named Orna Hedges, she dies in Redlands just a couple of weeks after Cora Stanton is found and after the Estep children die. And it is determined that she ate an orange that had been poisoned. Now, the sample of the orange was sent to a lab, and though they were able to determine there was a toxic substance in the orange, they were not able to pinpoint exactly what kind of poison it was. And they were never able to determine where she got that specific orange. And no one else in her family suffered any food poisoning or anything, you know. It was a complete mystery. So there I had, just with these three children who were poisoned, given poisoned food and candy by somebody who it's never determined whom, and this woman who's a complete stranger in town. She found that she has poison in her stomach. Interestingly enough, the poison in her stomach was identified. It was bichloride of mercury. And with just that alone, those four victims, I thought, wow, something funny's going on here. This, to me, looks like the hand of a killer, serial killer. Well, then there's the issue of the man whose remains were found around the time that the whole Cora Stanton issue was going on. And he was determined to be a suicide because they found him up in the foothills in San Bernardino with a gunshot wound to the head, and of course a gun on the site there near his hand. And however, his remains are so mummified that he can't be identified except for the wallet in his pocket. And he's not been seen around town for 3 months, but nobody thought to look in his room in that 3 months until the day he's discovered dead, and there they find his Masonic and Knights Templar regalia laid out. He was a member of those two fraternities, plus his alleged suicide note. Now, during this time also, Cora Stanton is determined, before she's even identified, she's determined to be a suicide. In fact, a coroner's jury is put together quickly, and they rule that she was definitely a suicide before they ever even find a suicide note. So here we have these two adults under these interesting, curious circumstances, both determined to be suicides, three poisoned children. And then we have the papers saying more than once about Cora Stanton before she's identified that no lady's hat, no purse, no suicide note was ever found. They say that more than once, and lo and behold, after the jury has decided she's a suicide and, you know, if this case is cut and dried, it's over, then a man stumbles upon, wouldn't you guess it, a lady's hat, a purse, and a suicide note. Very interesting.
Very convenient.
Very convenient.
Mm-hmm.
So that, all, those facts right there are the basic facts, which really, that I learned the first day of research, and really set me off on a quest to determine, okay, what exactly is going on here.
Okay, let me ask a question or two before we proceed.
Mm-hmm.
When they found Cora Stanton's body, was she wearing her shoes?
Yes, and the labels had been removed.
In approximately 70...
Had been removed or scratched out to where the lettering could not be identified.
Well, something like 70 to 80% of suicides, the people remove their shoes before they commit suicide. And I was asked one time, actually, I made that statement on the air one time, and I was asked.
Their items where they can be found. And what's interesting is her alleged items were found under a bush several hundred, you know, several feet away from where she's in the lake, on the other side of a fence that is the boundary of the park. Now, what's interesting is this was an area that had already been searched more than once by the police. And yet, this is where her items are found after she's already determined to be a suicide.
Who found these items?
A gentleman who had worked for the railroad by the name of John Malik. And there was never anything in the record to determine if he was ever investigated as a possible suspect. And we, Rick and I have a co-author on this, Richard B. Spence, who's unfortunately not able to be with us tonight because he's on the road on the way home from a vacation. And we never found anything to implicate Mr. Malik or that indicated that they, you know, looked at him for that in any way.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, does not disqualify him necessarily, because I want to emphasize to everyone that this is a big mystery. There is no answer, sure answer here. The only remaining record of this are the newspaper reports from 96 years ago. The police records, we were told, no longer exist. Nothing prior to 1930 in the police records exist in San Bernardino, according to the police department.
Okay. Now, what time of year was it when she was found in the water?
Pardon?
What time of year?
It was in November.
It was cool.
It was found on November 19th and was determined to have died sometime around midnight.
Okay. How was she dressed?
She was wearing a dark skirt, a blue blouse, leather shoes. That was pretty much what she was wearing.
Any bruising?
Very common clothing for ladies to wear. She was, by the description, she was probably what would have been, middle to upper middle class.
Okay.
Maybe, you know, might have been from a wealthy family. Who knows?
Any bruising on the body?
There were bruises on the upper part of one leg and down by her ankle, which I found to be quite interesting, because that could have been where a killer might have, in a struggle with her, grabbed her, held her down, as he held her head in the water, you know, held the rest of her body down. What was
okay,
this... was that it apparently was not a sexual assault, because, of course, in her mid-30s, it was determined that her hymen was intact, they found out during the medical examination. So she had not been raped. So that apparently was not, if this was a murder, that was not the intention.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, her shoes are on her feet. That is not a common thing in a suicide. It's an uncommon thing, actually. But that's not, there's not a hard, fast rule about that, but it is common, very common, more than 50% of the time they take their shoes off. I started to say earlier, and I don't think you were hearing me, that I was asked about that on air one time. Well, why do they take their shoes off? Well, folks, we can't ask them. We don't know why. When they commit suicide, you can't then ask them questions about why they did the things they did. So we don't know why, but that does go with it. Now, let me ask you this. It was very common back in the early 1900s for women to button up their blouse all the way to the neck. Do you know if any of those buttons were undone?
There's no details as to that.
Mm-hmm. Because that's also a very common thing, is people will open the neckline, unbutton their blouse or their shirt, partially, you know, and open it up as if they're trying to get some air. In a suicide, that's also very, very common. What about the physical evidence on the bank of the lake there, on the shoreline? Was there anything about that?
No sign of any struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they did not find any other personal belongings of the woman. Those were, allegedly, those were found under that bush.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we shall return after this. Welcome back. We're talking with Walter Bosley this evening, and Walter, you've laid out for us, some mysterious circumstances related to the death of this woman. But let's move on to what have you found that would support your idea that she was murdered?
Well. Those clues right there, those events, those details I provided you a few moments ago, those are really strongly supportive that there was some foul play involved. You have that many, possible victims with that many circumstances that are so close to one another. So many people poisoned and There's another victim I didn't, you know, get to before. His name was E. Percival Braid, and he was the last victim to die in this mystery in this time frame in early December, just days after Orta Hedges. And he also allegedly shot himself. And what was interesting was he shot himself while his sister and his landlord were in the house. And they apparently didn't hear it, because none of them knew he was dead until the sister went to get him for breakfast. And he shot himself with a pistol that had been stolen from the office of a lawyer, or one of the local city attorney's offices. And this pistol had been used earlier that year in another suicide. And somehow Braid, who was a law student, and an estate planner in the area, highly regarded, apparently a good guy for all intents and purposes, he got his hands on that gun, and that's what he shot himself with, by just wrapping the blankets around his head. I would argue that they still would have heard some report of the gun, but this was the circumstance of the last death, the seventh person, and again, it's another alleged suicide, you know, a guy shooting himself, but nobody hears it.
All right, let me ask some questions about that. He had blankets wrapped around his head, right?
The way it was described was he wrapped bedclothes around his head, which bedclothes generally means a blanket or sheet.
Yeah, and the gunshot, was it shot from outside through the blanket? Or was it shot from inside the blanket?
Again, no details regarding that.
Well, just having the blankets wrapped around one's head is certainly very non-typical of a suicide, although anything's possible. But, you know, it'd be interesting to know if
that... if they're talking about the bedclothes wrapped around his head, the idea was that he was, to, you know, having the gun underneath them. Mm-hmm. To muffle the shot. Clearly, if the gun were outside, then they should have heard the report of the pistol in the house. But to go back to your question, it was just the suspicious nature of the circumstances and details around all these deaths that really led me to suspect that there was homicide involved here.
Okay. I understand that it led you to suspect there was homicide, and that's what gets you started investigating now. What did you turn up in your investigation that would support your concept that this is homicide?
Primarily the fact that it's homicide is a theory.
Mm-hmm.
But what really supports, what originally supported that it was homicide are those details. It's the fact that they're, you know, the three children, those were not suicides.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody gave them poison candy and that poison orange. So somebody was there in that town that killed those children. And then you have, you know, the direct circumstances of the deaths. But then when you start looking into their lives, you know, you begin to see the possibilities. O.H. Bailey was a man who was from back east. And he was, the way they describe him was an itinerant worker in the orange grove. He lived in a boarding house downtown. He apparently was going deaf and was troubled by that. He was, middle-aged. He was about 50 years old. And, you know, the story was that he was depressed about that. The circumstances of the fact that where he's found, the record shows three different possible locations. In other words, between the newspapers and the coroner's report and the available details, they've got this guy's body as being found either directly beneath the giant arrowhead on the mountains here, or below, I should say, not beneath, below, or in a position 7 or 8 miles away near the community of Rialto, or 2 or 3 miles east of the arrowhead near a ranger station. So in other words, the sources can't decide where this guy's body was in the first place. And the places that they've got him are far enough apart to make you wonder, okay, what's going on here? Is someone trying to cover something up? It really wasn't until we started digging into the more esoteric aspects and what was going on in the area beyond these individuals that we were really able to start formulating a theory as to who might have killed these people. And that led us to, you know, we looked historically what was going on, and we found that there was a lot of espionage activity due to World War One. As it turns out, in California, there was something known as the German-Hindu Conspiracy. In other words, German and East Indian intelligence agents were busy bees. We were all over California because the Germans were running weapons to the East Indians through the United States. They were shipping them through the Southwest on trains and putting them on boats in San Diego to smuggle them across the Pacific to Burma. The reason they were doing this is Germany at that time was at war with England, of course. It was World War One. So, your enemy's enemy is your friend. Germany was currying favor, no pun intended, with India to have India kind of keep England busy on two fronts for them. And, of course, the Indians were glad to do business with the Germans and get these weapons. So, when you have something like that going on, the area through which you're channeling these arms and resources, you're going to have your agents there to kind of facilitate the process and oversee it. Now, what's interesting is San Bernardino was, and still is actually greatly, but at that time especially, was a major railroad hub in the southwestern United States. Anything that the railroads brought from the rest of the U.S. east of California and then on up north and across the Pacific, if it went by rail, it had to go through San Bernardino. So that made San Bernardino a place where there were very likely intelligence agents involved in this weapon smuggling right here in town. So we have to ask ourselves, was Cora Stanton, this mystery woman, this stranger, was she involved in the intelligence community during World War One? The British were using female agents in America at that time. So was she a British agent working undercover who ended up getting killed in the line of her work by either a German or an East Indian agent? Was she a German agent? Was there something to do with spies going on here? That was one possibility that popped up on our screen and made us wonder, okay, was this the source of the killer? Also, E.P. Braid was British-born and was known to be very active in the British War Relief. So he might have popped up as a target to the German or East Indian agents and crossed swords with them, and he was very, very possibly, from the existing record, the best candidate to be a victim of espionage-related murder. And, of course, O.H. Bailey, who was from the East Coast and, died under such strange circumstances, we're not even sure that the virtually mummified remains found in his suit with his ID was even actually O.H. Bailey. That could have been anyone's body dressed up like him and the ID placed on his person to conveniently say, oh, Bailey's dead. The real Bailey might have been an agent, for all we know. So these are some of the reasons that, the things we found that pushed us even farther along the line of, wow, something very strange is going on here. However, the espionage possibility does not answer to the children.
Right.
That one just did not make sense to Rick and I. And you guys know my background in counterintelligence, counterespionage, and such. I spent a career doing that stuff. And Rick Spence, my co-author, has been a consultant to the International Spy Museum. He's written books on the history of intelligence activities. One of them is which is Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence, and and the occult, and of course a book on Riley, the Ace of Spies, so to speak. So we're two guys who kind of know the intelligence world, and we agreed that the whereas Cora Stanton, E.P. Braid, and O.H. Bailey may fit as being victims of espionage, secret espionage wars, the children do not.
Well, and that's the note that I just wrote down here on my notes, and I was going to ask you about, and you brought it up. I just wrote down, as you were speaking earlier about this espionage angle, the note I wrote says espionage doesn't fit with the death of the children. Right. And then you brought it up.
Right.
So that's
We started looking, okay, what's another direction we could look? What else do we have here?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where things, I won't go there yet. I'll say this. We actually looked at just the old-fashioned, did we have a plain old criminal psychopath in town? Well, yeah, that's possible. It's very possible that this, if it was homicide, that this could have been explained by just a homicidal maniac in the town who did these things and got away with it. However, again, there was another option that we felt we wanted to look into, and it was just as viable, and that was the presence of spiritualists. Now, already being versed and interested in the legendary battle that Harry Houdini had with the corrupt spiritualist mediums in the 1920s, this, of course, piqued my curiosity. What really convinced Rick and I that there might be indeed something to this initially was this little fact. Harry Houdini, in his famous battle against the spiritualist mediums, was part of a team put together and led essentially by the Dr. Walter Franklin Prince, who was the head of the American Psychical Research Society at that time in the 1920s. In 1915, Dr. Walter Franklin Prince, also the Reverend Dr. Walter Franklin Prince, that's one of his other titles, happened to be the rector, the head man, at St. John's Episcopal Church in San Bernardino.
Okay, we got to step away for break. We'll be back right after this, folks. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Walter Bosley. And Walter, as we went to break, you were talking about, you'd just begun to talk about, Reverend Dr. Walter Franklin Prince.
Right. And not only was he residing in San Bernardino at the time, but he got involved with the Cora Stanton mystery in that he volunteered to officiate the funeral that the city gave her. Through his church, gave his time and services, and almost immediately after that, he packed up and left San Bernardino. He and his wife left. They were gone before the end of the year, before the end of that month. Of course, Stanton was buried in the first week of December. And he went next to Boston to take over eventually the ASPR, which then is how he got actively involved in investigating corrupt spiritualist mediums. And, of course, with Harry Houdini, and, by the way, H.P. Lovecraft and Clifford M. Eddy, C.M. Eddy, Jr. Now, here's what's interesting. We've got Walter Franklin Prince in San Bernardino at the time and a player in this mystery. And in November, the month that Cora Stanton is found dead in the lake and a lot of this is going on, Harry Houdini himself is performing in Los Angeles at the Orpheum.
How far away is
Harry
that?
Harry Houdini in Southern California. We got Walter Franklin Prince in San Bernardino, a player in the mystery. But then we also have...
Hang on a second. How far away is San Bernardino from Los Angeles?
It's roughly 60 miles or more, depending upon what area of Los Angeles you're going to.
Quick trip by train.
By train or, the automobiles of the day, probably would take twice as long as it did. But, yeah, we're talking just hours.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Prince, along with Houdini on this stage of our mystery, there is the biggie, and that is Aleister Crowley. Now, the book goes into the great detail, and which I won't go into here. You can read the book. But this is how Rick Spence, who wrote Secret Agent 666, came into this project with me. I had found his book in the store, and I was fascinated with it. It was really, really interesting. And it astonished me to find that Crowley had been in California and in Southern California right smack during, this mystery, this strange thing that I had stumbled upon. So I thought, my gosh, with his reputation, this can't be a coincidence, right? So I contacted Rick, and I think you should read the book to get the details, but essentially, I want to say here that we ultimately determined that Crowley had no direct involvement in whatever nefarious activities went on here, and he very likely would have vehemently opposed it and just would have been very negative on anything like this. First of all, he had no respect for spiritualists, for one thing. I found that interesting. A guy with his reputation, and here was something really nefarious and dark that a lot of people would instantly point a finger to him at, and yet there's no evidence to indicate an involvement, and a lot of evidence to indicate that he would have been quite opposed to it. But yet there he was.
Mm-hmm.
But what was more interesting was, and this goes back to why I first was looking into this and what led me into this whole mystery. If you recall, I got into this because I was following up on research from my book on ley lines, the Disneyland book, a big fun, book that speculates all sorts of amazing things. Again, in comparison to this book, rather fluff. In that research, I had a guy I work with, an author, Sesher Ree, he's been on your show,
mm-hmm.
Who has been working with geomorphology and has developed his own theory relating to ley lines and their development and such for over 20 years. And he had provided me, in February of 2008, he had provided me with some maps of these energy ley lines that he has identified, using geomorphology, meaning that the energy flows along the terrain in certain places. He had provided me with these maps for my research. So I had them for like a year before making a very interesting discovery. Before I get to that discovery, what I learned about Crowley in Rick's book was that the journey he took from New York across the northern part of the United States and down the west coast from Seattle on down into California, all his stops were at significant points where there were major confluences, major spiral nodal points of intense lay energy, according to Sesher Ree. So let me recap that. At these maps, this is theoretical now, okay, but I have these maps. I'm this gentleman who does this, and he had done a whole map of the United States, and I learned subsequent to receiving that map that Aleister Crowley's journey in 1915, all his stops and the route he took was following this ley line system of energy. Okay? So I thought, wow, now that's really interesting. And the book delves into that. The book gives details about what we think about that and what Crowley might have been feeling. So that brought ley lines back into the picture of this mystery big time. Remember, it was a haunting on a ley line that led me into this with Cora Stanton, and now we had Aleister Crowley on the scene, and it appeared that he was following the ley line system right through Southern California. Now, then I proved that Crowley had to have come through San Bernardino at that time. Because of the Mexican War, all passenger rail traffic through the American Southwest was being channeled through San Bernardino. And Crowley had to have gone through based on his itinerary. So here I had Crowley in San Bernardino. Forgive me for getting his name flippy floppy. Here I had Crowley in San Bernardino. We discuss in the book what he might have been doing, if he might have met with Walter Franklin Prince, who certainly knew who he was, and what they might have discussed. And I thought, wow, okay, this is getting even weirder. Now, with ley lines now being back on the scene, we analyzed the victim sites in our mystery, Cora Stanton and all of them.
Okay, we have to step away for break. It's time for our top of the hour break, and we will pick up right there with the ley lines and the victims when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, hang on to your seat, because this story just gets deeper. It never finds the shallow water again. The whole thing about ley lines is something that Walter Bosley and Sesh Hari have laid out in several books. And both Sesh Hari and Walter have appeared here on this show previously talking about the ley lines. And you may remember that Walter Bosley and I went out to South Mountain, south of Phoenix, Arizona, and climbed it. You might remember that we talked about ley lines because the largest intersection of ley lines in the United States is right there at South Mountain. So there's a lot of mystery that goes along with ley lines, and Walter's going to be talking with us in just a moment about the location of the victims. He's going to be talking about the location of those victims in relation to ley lines. If you don't know what ley lines are, if you're new to all of this, ley lines are simply lines of energy that just naturally course around the earth. It's not like it's really not like your circulatory system with your blood, but kind of think of it in that way. It's energy coursing around the earth through these pathways. We're going to be back right after this. Don't go away. Just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're talking with Walter Bosley, and we're talking about this incredible new book that he's got. He and Richard Spence are the co-authors of this book, and this book is called The Empire of the Wheel. And as we went to break, Walter, you were preparing to talk about the ley lines and the locations where these victims had been found. So let's jump in right there.
Okay. Well, what we began to look at was the possibility of an association of the ley energy system, as identified by our source on geomorphology ley theory, Sesh Hari. who, by the way, has written a complete book detailing his theory. It's called The Handprint of Atlas, published a few years ago. You can check that out for his theory. And we had him take a look, and he kind of provided us with a map of the layout according to the terrain. He uses topographical maps as he saw it. Now, this was before he knew where the victim death sites were. Okay, I want to emphasize that. We had him look at the valley topographically and do his thing, okay, before he knew. And he included, he found it very interesting, and he included the giant arrowhead that I mentioned before, that victim O.H. Bailey was found dead near. Now, this giant arrowhead, anybody that's gone through the Inland Empire, through San Bernardino, is familiar with it. It's about 1,300 feet long and almost 500 feet wide. The mainstream consensus is that it was a natural, it's granite, and that it was formed by heat and such, coming up from the hot springs that are there. Some people attribute it to some, you know, megalithic ancient times. That's what Sesheri thinks it was, that it was placed there. And interestingly enough, this arrowhead is oriented to 17 degrees or magnetic north. And we sat down with the maps. Sesh did this, I did this. And when you draw a straight line from the arrowhead south across the valley, because it points south, oriented magnetic north, there's a line that goes from the arrowhead. You follow a line straight through to the nearby city of Riverside, kind of a sister city to San Bernardino. Now, this line points to, directly, takes you to, a monument in Riverside that is dedicated to two police officers who were slain in an ambush, which to this day is an unsolved crime, by the way. It took place in 1971. What's interesting about this monument is there's the way it's designed, there is an isosceles triangle design in the monument itself. So the line from the arrowhead in San Bernardino points to the top of this isosceles triangle. Now, this monument, Sesheri says, is the center of a major network of lay energy in downtown Riverside. Again, you don't have to believe this yourself. Just telling you what somebody who does and is into this stuff claims according to their geomorphology using topographical maps and such. And from there, the top of this monument, this isosceles triangle shape, if you follow one of the lines off this triangle, okay, straight across town, within a few blocks, the line goes across the Riverside Community College campus, and it goes right through where the alley between Terracina Boulevard and Fairfax Street were. And on October 30th, 1966, the Zodiac Killer murdered Sherry Jo Bates in that alley. Now, that kind of startled me. Here I've got this ley line configuration stuff going on. I've got this straight line coming out of the arrowhead, which Sesheri says is a major stress energy line that he calls the axis of equilibrium. And that axis of equilibrium coming out of an arrowhead oriented magnetic north goes straight across the valley to a monument to one unsolved crime, leading just blocks away directly to the site of a more well-known unsolved crime attributed to the Zodiac Killer. So I took that and I thought, oh my gosh. So I took the big map that Sesh had given. Now remember, this is the summer, spring 2009. I had received this map I'm talking about I've looked at the date, on February 11th, 2008, over a year before making this Zodiac connection, okay? I had the map a year before, and over a year before. And I sat down and I plotted all the known attack and murder sites of the Zodiac Killer, the seven up in the Bay Area, the couple that were killed at Gaviota, and also Sherry Jo Bates. And I found that, without exception, all those sites, there is lay energy lines running through them. So basically what I had discovered was the Zodiac killed all his, or attacked at least, because there were two survivors, all his known victims on ley lines, on ley energy. Basically, the hair stood up on my arms and the back of my neck when I realized this. I plotted it again. I had Sesh plot it. I had Rick look at it. I had, you know, a couple of other people. And again, the map I plotted it on, I'd had for over a year before I ever made a connection between this ley energy, what was going on in my mystery, and then all sorts of synchronicities started popping up. For instance, in the San Bernardino mystery, you have four male victims, three female, okay? And the Zodiac up in the Bay Area, you have four male, three female, all within a general metropolitan area, the San Bernardino mystery within the same metropolitan area.
All right, let's pause and explain the Zodiac Killer for the audience, because we have a lot of our audience that are not in the United States and may not be familiar with who we're talking about, what we're talking about when we say Zodiac Killer.
The Zodiac Killer is considered the most notorious unsolved the Zodiac Killer case is considered the most notorious unsolved murder case in the United States. You know, movies have been made directly about him. Movies have been inspired by him, like one of the, I believe, the original Dirty Harry film. Zodiac became famous for the seven attacks that he perpetrated up in the San Francisco Bay Area. There were two male survivors of these attacks and five who died. Also, as time went on, they discovered and were able to attribute a couple, a male and female, who were murdered at Gaviota State Beach near Santa Barbara, and of course Sherry Jo Bates, who I mentioned, in Riverside, California. And these happened a few years before the Zodiac emerged in the Bay Area.
Okay, why is he called the Zodiac Killer?
That's what he called himself. And I am not, I want to say right here, I am not the world's greatest expert on the Zodiac Killer. I've never purported to be. I'm someone who, you know, I'm as an investigator, I'm a former federal agent, as you know. I'm a licensed private investigator. Here I was investigating some stuff. I just have a natural interest in it. And I happened to find this connection to my research. And it does not point to a perpetrator. I cannot identify or confirm anybody's theory of any suspect with this. All I can do is contribute this possibility, this theory that the Zodiac was doing this, was killing people on ley lines. Now, remember, he said in one of his writings that he was doing it to collect slaves in the afterlife, which suggests some nefarious occult point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what to, you know, think about it other than what I was seeing. And the cue was that I had these maps a year, more than a year, before I made this discovery. And this is in the book. The details of this, Sesh then charted it out, and we show in the book in greater detail what we mean by this. And ultimately, this is the only Zodiac connection to our mystery. There is a chapter in the book dedicated to the similarities between what's going on, we think, with the Zodiac Killer, what we found, and what's going on with ours. The Zodiac Killer would have been way too young in 1915 if he was alive to have been involved in our thing. What we suggest is the possibility that because we think a group or a team was involved in the San Bernardino murders, which we call the San Bernardino working murders, because, and I'll get to that later, what the San Bernardino working is or was, we think. We think also that, and I'm not the first, Rick and I are not the first people that say this, that there might have been more than one person perpetrating the Zodiac crimes, because, you know, that maybe that's why they could never pin it on exactly on Arthur Lee Allen. Maybe he was just one of a few or several and he fit some of the stuff, but he didn't fit the most damning smoking gun. It's a possibility, and that's all we're saying. Our book does not get into who, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Our theory does not get into who. I'm not going to purport to know or to think I know who it was.
Okay, so the connection then, though, is the ley lines.
Exactly.
I have a question about that.
Pardon?
I have a question about that.
Okay.
Do you think that the ley lines, the energy running through the ley lines, has an effect upon some people, like it is alleged a full moon has upon some people, that causes them to go wacky and kill people? Or do you think that this was planned because there were ley lines?
If you know him, has brought that up too.
I'm sorry, I was still talking. I didn't hear you.
I said the author and researcher Mike Cleland, if you know him, has brought up that question, and it's a very intriguing question. It's very possible that but that assumes that you are someone who embraces the reality. Now, Rick and I, in our book, we are very careful to say that we think what so-called lay energy is actually telluric current. Now, telluric current is a very real scientific fact, reality. It is an ELF, an extremely low-frequency energy that runs through the terrain, and it has been used in telegraphy and ground radio and technology since the 1850s. It's what Nikola Tesla would tap into when he would do his experiments and such. So telluric current is a very real thing, and that is what we're saying is the energy running through what are commonly misreferred to as ley line. An actual ley line is a straight line between ancient temple sites. That's the technical actual definition. But we have come to use ley lines to mean just the energy grid that does indeed run through the earth. So if you accept that this extremely low frequency energy can affect the human psyche like that, then that's possible. But again, our book and our research is primarily a true crime investigation, and we say that you don't have to believe in this. What we're saying is we think the perpetrator believed in this.
Okay. Now, if it's one possibility is that the energy of these ley lines is affecting someone that causes them to kill people. Another possibility is that you have some occult person or group who has a strong belief in this energy and seeks out these ley lines for some type of rites or rituals or whatever. Which way would you bend on that?
I'm going to bend on the occult group that's consciously seeking this out. Just looking at, and I'll just say one more thing about the Zodiac, just looking at him, he was somebody that wasn't just an average Joe walking around and he happened to step onto the line and went nuts. There was a man who was possibly on a, if it was one, or there was, I would say, a criminal genius involved with Zodiac killing. So I lean towards a group predisposed to embrace these concepts and, looking to conduct a ritual. And the book delves into that and the historical precedent for it as well, which is kind of disturbing.
Well, I have said many, many times when it comes to things that are paranormal, when it comes to things that are occult, and they're not necessarily the same. It doesn't matter whether you believe there is some kind of power there.
Right.
What matters is that people who do believe will act in accordance with those beliefs.
Right. And speaking, one criminal investigator, experienced criminal investigator to another, the fact is, whether what the psychopath believes in is real or not, it's real to him.
Yeah.
Or it's real to her. And so you have to understand what is real in that criminal's mind in order to catch them, in order to solve what they've left unsolved. So again, we're not saying we believe what we think the killer believed in, but we're saying that it needs to be taken seriously as a motive on part of the killer.
Okay, so you have already said that you lean toward the idea that this is an occult a person with occult beliefs or a group of people with occult beliefs,
right,
that perpetrated not only Zodiac, but also back in the 1920s, this Cora Stanton and the other associated murders. Okay, what is it about your investigation that led you to think that there is some sort of occult connection here?
When I started looking at the spiritualists, okay, when you look at the history of the spiritualists, when you look at what was going on with spiritualism at that time, and when you do any study at all into the case with Houdini, you know, you begin to see certain things that pop up that are suspicious in relation to this mystery. And there were, here's what's interesting. In San Bernardino, the first spiritualist temple existed here at that time. And when it was founded, it was the very first spiritualist temple in the state of California. So it was a very important spiritualist center. Now, it was very active in 1915, very active. And so here you have a chapter, or whatever you want to call it, of spiritualists right here in San Bernardino, who again, are very active. And you have these victims who appear to be, you know, killed in association with something that spiritualists are very much into. And the book goes into this in detail. It points out from spiritualist writings and spiritualist leaders, them actually referring to the lines of energy in the earth and lay energy and such. And it has them referring to other things which are associated with these ley lines, to include ancient Egyptian magic, ancient Egypt, ancient Mexico, and the goddess Hecate.
All right. I want to get into all of that, but first, this. I think when most people hear the term spiritualist, they think in terms of New Age, let's all hold hands, kumbaya, love and light. That's not what you're referring to, is it?
That's exactly what I'm referring to, is that is what we know as the New Age, what you're talking about, its ancestors, its precursor, forefathers, whatever, its founders of what we know as New Age were the spiritualists, okay? So they are the legacy. Our New Age today is the legacy of the spiritualist movement in the United States. Now, that said, my co-author and I, we think that what was going on was a group embedded within spiritualism, specifically within the spiritualist temple here in San Bernardino, that was of a darker ilk, you might say. These would have been the spiritualists, you know, of the same mind associated with what happened to Harry Houdini. Let me say this. I am one of those who's convinced that Harry Houdini was murdered by the spiritualist mediums he was going up against and their associates. I am convinced, okay? You can't convince me otherwise at this point. So that was another thing that, you know, you have Prince here in San Bernardino, and in the decade before what happens to Houdini and what goes on there, he's here with this strange, you know, suspicious possible murder mystery going on, spiritualists very active in the city, and I might add, the spiritualist temple here was very active in the whole Cora Stanton issue. Now, you've got three children who are given poison candy and fruit, okay? And they don't get nearly as much press attention as this woman who allegedly was just a poor, sad suicide who killed herself in the lake. But the spiritualist temple, they venerated her. She was just, you know, this big, tragic figure in their eyes. And two nights before her funeral, a gentleman who, by the way, was known for being able to predict earthquakes because of his understanding of geomorphology, and he was known and had a reputation for reading the terrain and being able to find oil deposits and energy. Sounds a lot like what I described Sechery does. This man's name was Orlis Kennedy. Two nights before Cora Stanton's funeral, he delivers, as a member of the Spiritualist Temple, he delivers an address all about Cora Stanton to the members of the temple. She was belle of the ball, or the star of the show, as far as the spiritualists were concerned. Now, the smoking gun for me that really made me suspect spiritualist hand in this, or someone involved in the spiritualist, was the poison, okay? You had Cora Stanton with poison in her stomach, but you had the three children who were poisoned by an unknown poison, unidentified to this day, okay? When you study the history of spiritualists, you find that a knowledge of poisons and such is something that they are known for, okay? And that's in the book as well. So, you know, I looked at that, and of course, that leads us to, in 1926, if you read Kalish and Sloman's book about the secret life of Harry Houdini, it looks pretty much like Houdini was poisoned by them, and the punch that he received from Whitehead was just basically the last nail in the coffin. They knew that they had poisoned him enough that the punch would rupture his appendix. The appendix, of course, being exacerbated, the damage done by the poison that was in his system. So that, to me and Rick, was very suspicious, that you had these children, this, you know, this unknown poison, and you had spiritualists in the mix. So that's what led us there.
All right. Got some questions.
Uh-huh.
Was Cora a spiritualist? And
nobody knows. She could have been. We suggest that she might possibly have been a very... We suggest that the evidence suggests, we propose that the evidence suggests, that all these victims were human sacrifices, okay? Cora being the most special one. And the book gets into this in greater detail, but I'll share some of the details to give you the nature of all the synchronicities and the darkness involved with this.
Okay, but before you do, I've got... Hang on. We got to get to my second question before we take off on another tangent. And the second question is this: if she was not a spiritualist, what was it about her that I can understand? If she was a sacrifice, I can understand the spiritualist temple making her a hero. But the newspapers, you said, also really just overdid it. What is it about Cora that caused that?
Well, that's what I was getting to.
Okay.
I was actually answering this question.
Okay.
We say the evidence suggests, the details suggest, that because she was in her early 30s and she had red hair, auburn red hair.
Okay, we have to step away, and we'll pick up right there with Cora Stanton when we come back. Don't go away.
You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Walter Bosley. Walter, you were just about to tell us as we went to break the reason. You know, I said if she was a sacrifice in the eyes and maybe at the hands of these spiritualists, then I could understand why she would be such a big hero to them. But the newspapers also really made a big deal out of her. And you were just about to explain why.
Well, as I was saying, I was describing her, you know, woman in her early 30s, red hair, a virgin, interestingly enough, What does this say? Well, this to the occultist, to the spiritualist, to somebody who's into esoterica, this would clearly be a symbol of fertility. For instance, you actually have an image of the Magdalene. Now, we know Dan Brown and all the lore that has grown up around the Magdalene, who was red hair and allegedly had the child of Christ and all that lore that goes with it. But then, you know, you've also got even more ancient lore and... I'm sorry, the word is escaping me. But, you know, it's all this fertility symbolism that she very likely represented. And, of course, it's classic that, you know, the sacrifice of virgins. Now, it doesn't end there. Her very name, or her alleged name, Cora Stanton. Now, the book gets into this in much greater detail. In fact, I won't say it here, but we reveal... how one Catholic saint associated with this is actually a false identity to cover for an ancient goddess, and the ancient goddess Hecate, who we believe that if this were really human sacrifices, they were doing it in veneration of Hecate, which I'll get into in a little bit. But Cora Stanton, the very name itself, which we question being her real name. Now, Cora, the way she spelled it, or it was spelled in the alleged suicide note, was C-O-R-A, the classic American spelling, which was originated by James Fenimore Cooper in his novel, House of the Mohicans. Now, it came from mythology. The name Cora actually came from K-O-R-E, which is a short name, a diminutive, or a nickname for Persephone. In ancient mythology, Cora and Persephone are the same person. Now, if you aren't familiar with your mythology, Persephone is the young girl, the virgin, who was captured by Hades and taken to the underworld. And she had to be rescued by none other than Hecate. Cora's mother asked Hecate to go into the underworld and bring her back. There's a whole myth about how she was tricked by eating three pomegranate seeds and spends half the year in the underworld and half the year up above. Now, this is directly tied into all sorts of agriculture mythology, okay? Now, so here we have our victim, Cora Stanton, whose name is essentially Persephone. And the last name, Stanton, if you break that down etymologically, it means the place of standing stones, but it also means the place of the ancestors or the, you know, your dead ancestors, such like that. Well, what is a place of standing stones but a cemetery? So here you have Cora Stanton, Cora slash Persephone, goddess of the underworld, Stanton slash cemetery, the place of death. Now, cemeteries are notoriously associated with, in ancient mythology, with Hecate. She's the goddess of shadows. She's the goddess of the triple crossroads, which ties in with the lay stuff we'll talk about later. But Hecate is the goddess which kind of oversees and watches over cemeteries. And that's just where the esoterica begins in this. And the book gets deeper into it.
There is a symbol, I believe, for Hecate.
Yes.
What is it?
That's where the title comes from. Hecate's symbol is the wheel. Thus, Empire of the Wheel.
So, what we're looking at here is basically... if your theory is correct, we're looking at the spiritualist temple in San Bernardino in the 1920s, having essentially... I'm sorry?
1915.
Okay, but Cora Stanton wasn't killed until when?
1915.
Oh, 1915, okay.
Yeah.
So in 1915, you have the spiritualist temple in San Bernardino, essentially having infiltrated virtually every organ of society, because They have the newspapers participating. I think you said there was a monument built to Cora. Is that right?
No, there. I think you're thinking of the monument I talked about in Riverside.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about the Zodiac stuff. You have to kind of separate what we were talking about Zodiac was.
All right, so the Spiritualist Temple has this special service, and there's a special oration given in honor of Cora Stanton. Were you able to get the text of that oration two nights before the funeral?
No. I tried. The attempt, it just led into a dead end because the temple itself left years ago, and this was so many years ago that there's just no one to contact who would, even ask if it still exists. And that's too bad. It would have been nice. We do know the title. The title is Practical Lessons Suggested by the Tragedy of Cora Stanton, which seems innocuous enough, but... You know, what are practical lessons to you and I might be something different to, you know, the spiritualists. And I want to reemphasize here that, yes, there were a lot of people involved in the Spiritualist Temple in the city and all walks of life here, but what we're talking about is there was a group within the spiritualists, we propose theoretically, that would have been the ones who perpetrated this, the nefarious acts.
All right. Now... I want to go back to Reverend Prince here, Reverend Dr. Prince.
Yeah.
Walter Prince, Walter Franklin Prince.
Yes.
This guy he's the pastor of a church, right?
Right.
And what else do we know about this guy?
Walter Franklin Prince was becoming well known at the time for his studies into the paranormal. By the time that all this happened, he was already writing articles for the ASPR and working essentially for James Hervey Hyslop, who, if you study your occult and paranormal circles in the early 20th century, you will see who Hyslop was if you don't know now, and we talk about it in the book. But Prince was already involved in the paranormal and the occult as far as being a student and researcher.
Now, is this the guy that spent a great deal of time in India?
No, that was Mark B. Shaw, who was the a mortician at the time of the San Bernardino working / Cora Stanton mystery. He had been a Baptist minister and had spent 4 years, some years back, when he was younger, in India as a minister. He was originally from Nova Scotia, and he eventually landed in San Bernardino, where he was also an officer in the local National Guard unit, 7th Cavalry, San Bernardino.
Okay, and was he in any way affiliated with this Spiritualist Temple?
No, not that we found. And what's interesting is when I talked with his great-granddaughter, she remembers growing up, you know, her grandfather, who was Mark B. Shaw's son, was their family, even though that Shaw had been a Baptist minister and such and had been a missionary, he was very open to things like the paranormal and psychic things like, you know, spiritualists would be involved in and interested in. And her own grandfather, his son, was very much interested in these things, and she grew up with exposure to it. So you would think that Shaw would have been a member of this temple, but I found no record, no mention that he ever was. Which then again, you could say, well, maybe there was something about it he didn't like that turned him off. Who knows? But, no. Jaw was not a spiritualist, or at least not a member of the temple.
Did you find anyone else affiliated with this temple that had a background in India?
Affiliated with the temple, no, because it's very hard to find out, except for the ladies who were, the Cora Stanton's pallbearers were all women, and they were the only ones who were named. And the people who founded the temple, they were named, but it was founded in the late 1800s. I never found a list of, you know, the members of the temple in 1915, you know, a complete list, which is kind of interesting. However, a woman who came down and was one of the pallbearers for Cora Stanton, she lived in San Francisco. We were pretty sure. Her name was May Quirk, and she came down from Northern California to be a part of this. Now, you got to understand, Cora Stanton, that Cora Stanton case, it ended up in the papers in Salt Lake City, and I think Rick found one back east. I mean, this case was known all over California and around the western United States and a little bit back east. That's what was very interesting about this, and it was known because of this woman. Not because of the kids who were given poison, but because of this woman. And this woman, May Quirk, we found that she was probably, possibly, I should say, the same woman, the May Quirk woman we found, that was in spiritualist circles up in San Francisco. And what's interesting is, Jack and Charmion London, Jack London the writer, okay, they lived in the Bay Area, and his mother was a spiritualist, okay? Now, what's interesting is, Harry Houdini is reputed to have had an affair with Charmion London, Jack London's wife. And Charmion, she was friendly with the spiritualist. Jack London's mother was a spiritualist. And so here again you have Houdini and the spiritualist connection, and what happened to him. And you've got what we're looking into and what happened down here, and you've got this woman coming from the Bay Area to be part of this. Okay, was May Quirk, you know, some bigwig in what was going on? Who knows? But, you know, there you have another, admittedly tenuous, but at least a connection there, possibly, to what happened to Houdini.
I find it very interesting that so many spiritualists are interested in and involved in the funeral of Cora Stanton. If she were not a spiritualist, then there has to be some other reason that these people are very, very interested. And the whole theory about a sacrifice certainly becomes plausible. They're interested because she was their sacrifice. Do you know if there was any sort of high holy day for these spiritualists for which there would have been this sacrifice?
Throughout this mystery, the victims are the things that are happening to them, or they're dying on or around days that in which Hecate was venerated. It pretty much O.H. Bailey, the day he would have died was mid-August, and in mid-August there is a veneration day to Hecate.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this, so don't go away, folks. More to come. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Walter Bosley. Walter, we just have a few minutes left. I want to give you a chance to go ahead and knock that out about the dates of these deaths, and they were on or close to dates that were venerating Hecate.
Wow, that's when we cut off?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, I went on for several minutes.
Yeah, I know. You don't listen. You don't take a breath.
No, I didn't hear the connection. Okay, yes, these, like O.H. Bailey, you know, when he likely died was around or on the date in August that is used Venerate Hecate and Cora Stanton, and the two Estep children die in the month of November, which was a big month for Hecate veneration. Orta Hedges and E.P. Braid died around a time that was associated with ancient Lusitania, which we call Portugal. Now, what's interesting about that is, I won't go into those details, but you can read the book, but Sacherie provides an interesting little theory about what he thinks the connection of Lusitania to our mystery is, and it's a doozy. But that brings us back to Aleister Crowley, because as we know, Crowley in his intelligence duties was involved with the Lusitania, and
with the ship.
I want to say this about Crowley, is that within 18 months after passing through San Bernardino, he wrote his book Moonchild. Now, it wasn't published for several years after. It was written within 18 months of him passing through San Bernardino. And in that book, there are two cults, one good, one evil. And the evil cult is murdering people as sacrifices in certain geographical spots in veneration of Hecate. That
so do you think that Aleister knew?
That Aleister Crowley became aware of what somebody was doing or was planning to do here, and that inspired possibly that part of the plot of his novel. I mean, committing acts of murder and violence on the victims to draw energy up from the earth in veneration of Hecate. And the book goes into much greater detail as to why that's so significant.
But you don't think Aleister Crowley himself was involved in these murders?
No. And I know that some people are going to raise their eyebrows, but I came away from this convinced that Crowley would not have been involved in this.
Well, and look, I know that when you were researching this part of it, you and I discussed all of this thing with Crowley. And at one point, you were pursuing the notion that maybe he was involved.
Right.
And you cleared him out of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think if any portion of Moonchild was truly inspired by what happened in San Bernardino, it was the evil dark cult. There were other things that, you know, there are characters in there that are clearly people that he had had run-ins and stuff. I mean, not the whole entire book, but that portion of it, we think, was inspired by whatever it was he learned. And he might have learned it from Walter Franklin Prince.
Hmm. Interesting. Prince was a some type of a Christian minister, was he not?
Episcopal. And they themselves have an interesting background with both espionage, the history, you know, modern history of espionage, and magic.
Mm-hmm.
If you look into them. And there he was, a man very much versed and interested in the paranormal, as an Episcopal minister. I'll say that St. John's Episcopal at that time had a very questionable history that the book, our book Empire of the Wheel, goes into.
Do you think there's any possibility that Prince had at least some dabblings with this spiritualist temple?
Whatever his experience with them was, I'm convinced left a seriously bad taste in his mouth. I think that this mystery may be the thing that set him off onto going after the spiritualists. It's possible that he already was acquainted with Houdini. I mean, we did have Houdini in Southern California while this was going on. We don't know that they weren't already onto whatever they were onto, and this might have been the beginning of it. Maybe this was the beginning of it. Maybe this was the thing that set Prince, you know, in his position, so that in the subsequent years, when the whole Marjorie thing came up, that's why they so vehemently went after her and them. And, you know, Houdini and Arthur Conan Doyle were good friends until they had a falling out over his wife, you know, doing a fake seance in relation to his mother, and you know, that story is well documented elsewhere. But, you know, I think Prince is a key figure in this.
Wasn't there some... I may be mixing this book with I'll See You in Time, but wasn't there some connection to pedophilia?
Not that.
I mean, wasn't there one of these people? Yeah, wasn't one of these people suspected of it?
In time by the cult. But no, there was not. I don't recall anything about pedophilia.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, there's all sorts of all manner of other dark things, but no.
I don't know why, but it was because I'm an old guy. But I'm remembering something that obviously didn't happen. But it seems like I remembered some conversation we had where one of these people had been accused of child abuse. Okay. The reason that I pursued the thing about India has to do with the poisons being used that were not identifiable.
Right, and that's in the book.
And, okay, so you address that in the book. Certainly
exactly,
at that time...
specifically the poison tree, which was a deadly tree that the blossom was poison. It's used in India a lot to murder because it makes it look like someone simply had a heart attack. And, you know, somebody who was in India who, you know, spent some time there might have learned about this poison and been aware of it.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I was asking about which one of these characters had spent time in India. And as you pointed out, it was the mortician Mark Shaw.
Exactly.
And but he did not have a connection with the spiritualist church or spiritualist temple, did he?
No, as we said a few moments ago, not at all. Interestingly enough, because I went into his background, if you recall, of the things he was interested in. I talked with his great-granddaughter, and you know, mm-hmm. she grew up, her grandfather was his son, you know, grew up very comfortable with New Age and spiritualist concepts, you know, on that kind of New Age superficial level. But interestingly enough, no record, nothing to indicate that Shaw was ever a part of that temple.
Were you able...
That, Shaw was most likely, if anything, any involvement beyond being the mortician for, I think, five of the victims, was probably, if he had special knowledge that would have served, he probably would have been working with Police Chief Walter Shea, the investigators trying to figure out, you know, what was going on. That's our suggestion. But you have to read the book to see why we get there.
All right, tell us quickly where people can get the book.
At Amazon.com, it is a Kindle book, and I'd like to remind everyone that you do not have to have a Kindle device to read Kindle books. Amazon offers the Kindle program for free. You can download it for free onto your PC, laptop, smartphone, iPad, whatever, and you too can purchase Kindle books without having to buy a Kindle device.
All right, stay on the line with me for a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be it for this evening. I hope you have enjoyed tonight's show. Boy, I'll tell you what, you got to get the book. It is called Empire of the Wheel, and you need to get it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.